From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, going undercover to infiltrate the Mongols, the most violent motorcycle gang in the U.S. We talk with Billy Queen, a former undercover agent for the Bureau of Alcohol, Firearms, and Tobacco. He became a trusted member of the gang, accumulating evidence of rape, murder, and trafficking in drugs and illegal arms. After testifying against the Mongols, he had to go into hiding. Now he has a new memoir. Also, we talk with Anthony LaPaglia. He plays an FBI agent investigating missing persons in the TV series Without a Trace. He won an Emmy for his portrayal of Daphne's drunken brother on Frasier, and now he's starring in the new film Winter Solstice. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Mongols might not be as well known as their rival, the Hell's Angels, but the Mongols Motorcycle Club is considered the most violent motorcycle gang in the country, according to the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. My guest, William Queen, infiltrated the Mongols' San Fernando Valley chapter from 1998 to 2000 while working undercover for the ATF. He was at the center of the most extensive undercover investigation of an outlaw motorcycle gang in the history of American law enforcement. Using the name Billy St. John, Queen posed as a prospect, a provisional member of the gang, and rose as high as the chapter's secretary treasurer. After he accumulated evidence of illegal acts, ATF agents moved in throughout the L.A. region and parts of three other states, making arrests and seizing firearms, drugs, and stolen motorcycles. 54 Mongols were convicted, but it didn't put the gang out of business. The Mongols have a bounty on Queen's head, and he spent time in hiding, although he isn't quite hiding now. Queen's memoir, Under and Alone, has just been published, and the movie rights have already been sold. I spoke with him earlier this month about his undercover work. Billy Queen, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, you're not in disguise now, and I know that there are a lot of Mongols who would like to kill you. I mean, is it likely that anyone's going to bust into the studio while we're recording and try to take you out?
No, it's not likely. Nobody knows I'm here.
And is that the way your life is now? Nobody knows when you're where or...
That's kind of the way I like to keep it, yes. I don't want to stick my neck out there where it can get chopped off. So, yeah, I'm laying low.
I want you to describe the Mongols. Just like describe, in the world of motorcycle gangs, where do they fit?
Well, they're an old school motorcycle gang. They're what people probably think of as the Hell's Angels back in the 60s, riding free and doing exactly what they want to do. The Mongols, unlike the Hell's Angels, are more into the violence and intimidation. More so than the Hell's Angels or the Outlaws or Pagans. The Mongols want to be the most violent out there. They want to be noted as the baddest guys riding on two wheels.
How did you get the assignment from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms to infiltrate them undercover?
I've been working undercover for ATF for many years. And there were very few people in ATF, agents, that had the background, the undercover background that I had, that would stand up to the scrutiny of the Mongols. Plus, I was one of the very few at the time that that had the beard and the look, the personality, the character that could do it too. So I was asked by the case agent, in this case, John Ciccone, if I would do it. At the time, I was riding with the Hell's Angels, gathering information on them, and told Ciccone that I would give a shot at riding with the Mongols, because at that time, the Mongols were a much more violent group and perpetrating violent crimes in the L.A. area a lot more than the Hell's Angels were.
So before you could start riding with the Mongols, you had to convince them that you were serious and that you were their kind of guy. So why don't you describe that look a little bit that you, I think, cultivated even a little more for the Mongols?
Well, my hair was long. I had a long beard.
Long and pointed, right? A little point at the end?
Well, it got like that. But when I first went in, when I was riding with the Hell's Angels, I had a full beard. Later on in the investigation with the Mongols, I had cut most of that beard off and just had a real long goatee, Fu Manchu type operation going there. But I was also a person that would stand his ground in these rough bars that they hung out.
Give me an example of how you would do that.
Well, you have people that go to these bars and they drink, and a lot of them just want to fight. And they'd get loud and pushy and try to bully people around. Well, they found out real quick that I wasn't the kind of person that could be bullied around. If somebody wanted to get loud with me, I got loud right back with them. And if they wanted to push, I pushed back. And the Mongols are into that. They like that. And they saw that I wasn't a person that could be pushed around, and they liked that kind of person. And they began to invite me to other bars, and if they got into fights, I would stand there and stand in with them in these fights and stuff. And then they asked me to be a member. And to be a member, you'll start out as a prospect. And to try to let everybody know, when you become a prospect, these outlaw bikers wear patches or colors, if you will. They're the patch of the club, like the Hell's Angels, where you'll see a Hell's Angel rocker on top, and you'll see the Death Head in the center, and then you'll see a State rocker underneath it. Well, the Mongols have the same thing. I put on a lower rocker, started wearing a black and white patch that the Mongols wear and that everybody identifies with. And at that point, becoming a prospect, you become property of the club. And then at that point, the good times of just riding with them and shooting pool and drinking beer and going to entertainment events, it all changed when I became a prospect. I became their property, and at that point, I had to prove myself, and I had to do whatever any patched member in that club told me to do, to include assisting stealing motorcycles, running dope for them, standing up for them in these fights and things, which just whatever they wanted me to do. At that time, life became miserable at that point.
Is there anything that you flat out said no to?
No, I could not do that. I could not do that. I could have done it, but I would have been out of the club. The case would have been over. And I did. I got into some situations where it was just plain luck that I made it out of them, where they intended to rape women. And I knew that the case was going to be over. I couldn't rape women along with them. But it just so happened in one particular case I'm talking about, the women that they were planning on raping didn't show up. But again, I thought, this case is over with. The only thing I can do is get on my bike and just ride, try to get away from them, and the case would have been over. But I did luck out, and these women didn't show up, and it was a constant challenge like that.
One of the things you were asked to do was to snort a line of methadrine, and or snort two lines of methadrine, and was that so that you could prove yourself and prove that you weren't a cop, because it's illegal for a cop to do drugs unless, you know, it's illegal for someone in the ATF undercover to do any drugs unless their life is at risk. So was this a way to test you, or did they just want to see what you were like when you were high?
No, it was a test. That particular incident you're talking about happened in Laughlin, Nevada, and that was a test. Rocky, the Mongol that challenged me on that, put a knife in my face. After he had lined out those two lines of dope, he snorted one of them himself, methamphetamine. And then he turned around and pointed that knife in my face and asked me if that was too much for me. And it was clearly a challenge. And I was just lucky enough to be able to step in between Rocky and the table where the dope was and bend over like I was snorting it, and was able to wipe it off into the floor without him seeing it. But I knew I wasn't going to be able to continue with that. If there had been more people in the room, I wouldn't have gotten away with it. He was threatening me, whether I really thought that he was going to stab me if I did not do that line of dope or not, I don't know. I just lucked out that particular time, was able to wipe that off into the floor. However, soon as I left that room with him and met up with a group of other Mongols, Rocky told the other Mongols, hey, he did the line of dope, and everybody was happy because they know the cops can't do dope, and everybody was high-fiving, yeah, he's okay. So it was a challenge.
Did you not do the meth because you were afraid you'd be out of control, or because you were afraid it would end your assignment because it would have been illegal for you to do it?
No, this is the way that it is, and this is a big issue. A lot of people ask this question, how could you do this without doing dope? We know you had to do dope. You had to do it, but this is the way it goes. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms has a policy. You don't do dope unless your life is threatened. And then if you do it, it's just like you had gotten injured on duty. You'll go to the hospital. You'll have blood work done. They will watch you. You'll fill out all the reports just like you would in a situation of getting hurt on the job. Now, here's another thing. If you were to make the decision as an undercover agent, hey, I'll just do the drugs. I won't tell anybody. You are subject to take a drug test at any time with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. They give you random drug tests. And if you haven't told them that you were first forced to do drugs and the drugs show up in your system, you're fired. So I wasn't willing to risk my job, and I really didn't need to risk my job. Time and time again, I lucked out on the drug thing. But the biggest thing that carried me through was that the president of the chapter that I was in, Domingo, had just gotten out of prison, and he was having to take a drug test every week. He couldn't drink alcohol, let alone do methamphetamine or cocaine or smoke marijuana. So when the drugs came out, everybody would offer Domingo the drugs first before they would offer them to me. When Domingo turned them down, I put my arm around Domingo and hugged my president and said, if my president's not doing them, hey, I ain't doing them. And that got me through for months.
I thought you were going to tell me he needed your urine to be drug-free so that he could pass his test.
They'll stand there and they'll watch you. When you take a urine test, they stand there and they watch you.
Make sure it's yours.
Yeah.
My guest is Billy Queen. His new memoir is called Under and Alone. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is William Queen, and he was an undercover agent with the ATF, and he infiltrated the Mongols, which is considered to be the most violent of all the motorcycle gangs, and that case has ended up in several convictions, and there's parts of that case that are still pending. He's written a new memoir called Under and Alone. What's it like to ride in a pack of, like about 100 motorcyclists from the Mongols?
It's awesome. It's just absolutely awesome. The first time that I ran with these guys across town in Los Angeles, there was probably 150 or 200, and it was like some giant centipede rolling through town, connected. These guys ran their own traffic. They sent people into intersections and stopped traffic, and they rolled through. It didn't make any difference whether the cops were there, the highway patrol. They rolled through the intersections, and 150 or 200 Harley-Davidsons screaming through town like that is an awesome sight to see.
I found your observations of the women who hang with the Mongols really interesting. And you say basically that the women are designated as sexual property of an individual member or of the gang. What does that actually translate to?
Well, they are, and they wear patches that say property of an individual or property of the Mongols, although you don't see too many of those around anymore, but they are considered property. Right there in a lot of cases, not as valuable as the motorcycles they're riding. And if they want the women to go out and make money and support the men, they do that, and seemingly with honor and glad to do it. The Mongols can't ride around with patches on their backs all the time. They get stopped by the police all the time and don't carry weapons with them, but they'll give those weapons to the women. And the women will carry the weapons. The women will carry the drugs for them. But, putting them in jeopardy of being busted.
Well, one of the things that really puts the women in jeopardy is just being close to these guys, because it sounds like the members of the Mongols would, you know, readily beat their girlfriend or wife. I'm not sure what the reasons they would give were, but you describe one time where one of the wives was beaten so that her face basically split open. And you were called in. They knew that you could do, a fairly decent job of stitching skin, because they'd seen you stitch one of your wounds, a knife wound in your palm. And so, yes. So you know, the husband called you to come in and stitch up her face. Why don't you describe the scene you walked in on?
Well, I had been up most of the night and had gone home to my undercover pad, and it was about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, the best I can remember. I got a call from Domingo, who wanted me to go over to Evil's house, a gang member, and because he had beaten his old lady, and he had just gotten out of the jail not too long before that for beating her, and he knew that he'd be on the way back to jail for beating her again, but this time he had hit her and split her lip through and through, almost all the way up to her nose. It required, the best I can remember now, 4 or 5 stitches on the outside and a few stitches on the inside. But they had called me, and I rode over to Evil's house, and I walked back in the bedroom when she was lying on the bed, and they had taped her face together where it was split apart.
With scotch tape?
And with scotch tape. And they were saying, "Billy, sew her up. We need you to sew her up. We can't take her to the hospital. They'll call the cops. Eve will be back in jail." And I pulled the tape off of her, and I looked at it. It was split all the way through and through. And I told her, "I can't do that. You know, I've sewed things up, people up on the outside, but not on the inside like that." I told them they really need to come up with some kind of a story, take this girl to the emergency room. And finally, they just said, "No, if you're not going to do it," they started taping her back together. And I realized they weren't going to do it. And there was only a certain period of time that you can leave a wound open like that without stitching it before you face surgery. So I agreed to do it and rode home and got my stuff, and then rode back to the house and stitched her up inside and out.
How did it heal? Do you know? How's her scar?
You know, it healed really well. She was asthmatic, and she ended up having to go to the doctor anyway for her asthma. She had the doctor take a look at it, and the doctor looked at it, and he said, "Oh, it was a good job." He said, "I would have used a different technique, but it was a good job." I saw her, you know, a month or two later, and it looked really good. It looked better than my own hand that I sewed up myself.
Did it surprise you that there were women who willingly took on this kind of life, that they were willing to be somebody's sexual property? They were willing to accept being beaten. They were willing to live a life where the men basically really didn't care about their well-being.
You know, it did surprise me. And it surprised me every time that we were out somewhere, or I was out with the Mongols, and they would go into some club and some girl would be willing to climb on the back of one of those motorcycles and ride off. I mean, I would look at her thinking to myself, "You ain't got no idea what you're getting into." And it just surprised me that they would climb on the bikes and do that. My president, his old lady, she was the daughter of a police officer in the area. And she was beaten one day. And I remember she told her father, "That's part of it. That's just part of it." And so, yeah, it was amazing to me. And, you know, the guys can be rough and they can be violent and they can be nasty. But, you know, it surprised me that there were women out there that could be just as rough and nasty as they are.
So how did you decide to actually end the operation? What was the last straw where you decided it's over now?
Well, it was a progressive thing. The longer I was in, the more isolated I had become. I lost contact with my wife. I had lost my girlfriend. I had lost contact with my friends, with my colleagues at ATF. For the greatest majority of the time, I was only able to talk to John Ciccone. All the rest of the time, I was living the life of a Mongol. I slept with them. They slept with me. I all my partying, it was all done with them. All hanging out day after day. I had become a Mongol, and that's the only life that I had. But over that 2-year period of time, because of all the criminal acts that had occurred, that we had passed on, and that other agencies had learned about, other state and local agencies in the Los Angeles area, they knew about the murders. They knew about the extortions and the robberies and everything else that went on. Well, the ATF would go to those agencies and say, look, just back off. We know what's going on. We're handling it. More agencies knew that ATF was targeting the Mongols. They didn't know that they had that ATF had an undercover agent inside the Mongols, but they knew that they had an investigation going against them. And the more people that knew it, the more the chances were that they were going to find out what was going on. And if they would have found out at any time that I was an undercover agent, it would have been my death. And I knew that. And I knew that I had used up my luck in this investigation. And it had worn on me, and I was getting worn out. I was getting tired. And it was just time to end the investigation.
Billy Queen, his new memoir is called Under and Alone. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Virginia Woolf's long-neglected novel, Night and Day, in the Barnes & Noble Classic Series, available in stores and at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Books, publisher of Letters from the Hive, An Intimate History of Bees, Honey, and Humankind by Stephen Buckman and Banning Replier. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, testifying against the motorcycle gang members who had thought of him as their riding and drinking buddy, we continue our conversation with former ATF undercover agent Billy Queen. And we talk with Anthony LaPaglia. He plays an FBI agent on the CBS series Without a Trace and stars in the new movie Winter Solstice. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Billy Queen. Working as an undercover agent for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, he infiltrated the most violent motorcycle gang in America, the Mongols. His new memoir about that assignment is called Under and Alone. After gathering enough evidence for authorities to move in, make arrests, and confiscate drugs and illegal arms, Queen had to testify at the gang members' trials. 54 Mongols were convicted. What was it like to show up in court to testify against the guys who you had actually become friends with? I mean, you had to be tight with them in order to not blow your cover. So you'd had created some kind of bond, and they did trust you, they did respect you, and here you were proving that the whole thing was based on deceit, and now you were turning against them.
That's true, and in some cases that was very difficult for me. Domingo became a friend of mine. Rocky became a friend of mine. Evil, JR, a number of them became friends of mine. But when I say friends of mine, they really became friends of Billy St. John, not Billy Queen.
Your persona, your undercover persona was Billy St. John.
Right. Sometimes it was hard to differentiate between Billy St. John and Billy Queen. And that did make things tough for me. If I could... I'll back up and tell a quick story about that. My mother passed away while I was doing this undercover operation. And I had been working for weeks on end without a day to myself. And when that happened, I went to the Mongols and said, look, guys, my mama died and I got to go home. And, you know, they said, hey, take off, Billy. We'll see you when you get back. And I told ATF, hey, I'm taking off. My mom died and I'm going home. And I took off, and it was in late December when that happened. And I got back to L.A. Right when the New Year's run, the Mongols' New Year's run was to occur. And ATF said, get back on the bike, get back in there. This is a big run. We can get information here. We can do all these things. And I did get back on that bike. And I rode back into the Mongols, and I rode to a guy's house by the name of Evil. I got off my bike and walked up to Evil's door. When I knocked on his door, Evil came to the door. And I reached out for the usual Mongol handshake, and he grabbed me. And he gave me a big hug, and he said, I love you, Billy. He said, I'm sorry about your mom. And I could have fell to my knees. I almost cried. And the next guy that came in, it was the same thing. Big JR came in. He grabbed me around the neck, and he said, I love you, brother. I'm sorry about your mom. And, you know, not one ATF agent said that. I didn't get a card from them. I didn't get a sorry about your mom, nothing. But these guys all grabbed me around the neck, told me that they loved me and that they were sorry about my mom. And I'm going to tell you what, I was close to climbing on that motorcycle and riding off as a Mongol. It became confusing and difficult.
You know, reading your book, I felt really bad for your ex-wife. I mean, you're not even married anymore. And when the bust happened, she and your two sons had to leave their home and go underground, a kind of witness protection type of thing, because, you know, their lives would be in jeopardy from Mongols who wanted to seek revenge against you. And, like, she had nothing to do with it. She's not even married to you anymore. It seems so awful.
Yeah, it did. It upset her life too, and I was very sorry for that. And I don't hesitate to say, if I had this thing to do over again, I wouldn't do it over again.
Really? You wouldn't?
I lost too much. You know, it upset her life. It upset my kids' life. I mean, it needed to be done. Law enforcement needs to be on these guys all the time, everywhere, from coast to coast. But I was the wrong person to do it. The guy that goes undercover, he doesn't need to have a family. Things are going to happen to him. Things are going to happen to his family. And when they consider undercover agents for an assignment like this, that's one of the things that they do need to consider. Hey, you're not going to be able to stay here if you got a family. Your family's not going to be able to stay here. You're going to have people looking for you. And had I known the way that this thing was going to turn out, I wouldn't have done it. I would have helped. I would have helped take these guys off, everything that I could do. But I wouldn't have been the one that was undercover and living the results of that undercover operation.
So what kind of life do you have now? I mean, you're not in disguise because they already know what you look like. You lived underground for 2 years, but with the publication of the book, you've emerged again. I mean, what's your life like now, to the extent that you can divulge that?
Well, I'm kind of waiting to see what kind of reaction that I'm going to get out of the Mongols with all this coming out now. And I sleep with a double-barrel shotgun by my door. I never go anywhere without a gun. And I'll never be able to stop looking over my shoulder. I know that. And it's kind of a wait and see thing. I imagine it's not going to take too long before we start getting reaction out of the Mongols. But ATF keeps an eye on them, and we have ways of gathering in intelligence and knowing what they're thinking or what they're up to. And so I'm kind of waiting to see, but I know that I'll never be able to stop looking over my shoulder, and I won't.
Well, William Queen, I want to wish you good luck. Be safe. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, Terry, thanks for having me on.
William Queen's new memoir about infiltrating the Mongols is called Under and Alone. Coming up, actor Anthony LaPaglia. This is Fresh Air.
Tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to run a test on that gun. My guess is it'll be a forensics match for the gun that killed Tyson Dibbs. And even if it's not, those hands that were just around your neck, they're going to be there again, I promise you. And next time, we're not going to be here to stop him. Where's the boy?
That's Anthony LaPaglia in a scene from his CBS series Without a Trace. He won a Golden Globe for his portrayal of an FBI agent heading the Missing Persons Division in the CBS series. He won an Emmy for his performance on Frasier as Daphne's drunken, obnoxious brother Simon. LaPaglia's movies include Lantana, The Guys, The House of Mirth, Company Man, and So I Married an Axe Murderer. Now he's starring in the new movie Winter Solstice as a single father raising two teenage sons. The family is having a hard time recovering from the loss of his wife. He's losing touch with his sons. The younger one, played by Mark Webber, is getting into trouble at school. The older son, played by Aaron Stanford, wants to leave home. In this scene, he breaks the news as his father is doing paperwork and his younger brother sits on the couch.
What do you mean you're moving out and getting your own place?
Actually, I'm leaving town. I'm gonna go to Tampa, stay with Brian for a while, and then maybe get a place down there.
Why?
I don't know exactly.
You're leaving town and you don't have a reason.
No, I have reasons.
Well, what's your reason? Where do you think you're going?
This is between you two.
I want you to sit down over there, Pete. Pete, get back in here and sit down!
Hey, take it easy.
Why didn't you talk to me? Gabe? Why didn't you talk to me?
A scene from Winter Solstice, which also stars Allison Janney. I asked Anthony LaPaglia what drew him to the film.
The script was very sparsely written. So it was much more about, you couldn't lean on dialogue or words for performance. You had to really kind of use your emotional skill as an actor to get across whatever you wanted to get across.
Well, exactly. I mean, your character isn't very verbal, and the story takes place during a time of his life when he's feeling kind of helpless and paralyzed about either moving his life forward or helping his sons move their lives forward. So what are the difficulties of that kind of role, where it's really not in what you're saying, it's kind of in what you're thinking, which you can't telegraph?
Well, you have to, you know, it just means that instead of, you know, in a lot of film and television these days, you have a character telling you what he's about to do, and then you see them do it, and then they tell you what they did. So
I've seen that TV show.
Yeah.
I've seen that movie, and, too.
Yeah, and there's a lot of that. And therefore, you just, you know, basically your narrative, your running commentary. And there's very few movies now that kind of trust that the audience doesn't need everything spelled out to them. in so clearly and so simplistically. And I'm attracted to that kind of material. It's more difficult because you have to focus more. You have to really kind of be connected to the person that you're acting with. And it's really about more, it's more what happens between the lines than the actual lines. And often the lines themselves are irrelevant. It's the undercurrent of what's going on between the two characters that you have to build. And that makes it a more difficult job in terms of acting.
Your co-star in the movie is Allison Janney. Now, she's one of the stars of The West Wing. You star in the TV series Without a Trace. There was a period when it seemed that movies offered the great roles and TV was like the lesser storytelling. And TV used to threaten to ruin film careers. And now that's really changed. You know, there's some terrific dramas and comedies on TV. And a lot of actors make their career in television, and that boosts their movie careers. And I'm wondering if you feel you've seen the relationship of television and movies change in the lives of actors.
Oh, sure. When I started, to do television was to admit defeat and admit that you were a second-rate actor that wasn't capable of doing movies. It was a very strong prejudice. It's interesting, too, because in England, there's no distinction. You do theater, you do TV, you do movies. You have to because that's how you make a living. They don't have a star system. Nobody gets paid $25 million a film. So you have to work, which in the end makes you a much more complete actor. Here, there was always a very strong stigma attached to, if you were a TV actor, why would people pay money to go? If they could see you for free every week, why would they pay money to see you in a theater? That's changed to the degree where if you don't have a TV series, it's hard to get a movie career. It's done the complete turnaround.
Did you have any reservations about taking the leading role in Without a Trace?
No, none. For a multitude of reasons. By the time that role came to me, I was 43. I was just about to have, my wife and I were about to have our first child. I didn't want to go to Canada anymore. I didn't want to go to Prague anymore. I didn't want to travel to go and do films anymore. I also didn't want to work for scale anymore. No matter what film I did, basically since the advent of the $25 million actor, and I don't begrudge those people at all. It's like, if you can make $25 million for doing a film, then God bless you. That's great. The problem is that the studio then turns around and cries poor for everyone else. And so, other cast members, crew, they're all supposed to work for basically scale because they paid one person all this money. And quite frankly, I got sick of it. I got sick of being asked to be a supporting actor in a movie with someone who, some of them were good and some of them weren't so good. Some of them were just flavor of the year. And asked to work for basically scale. And for as much as I love acting and I treat it as a craft, it's still my occupation. And I still want to make a living out of it. And it just seemed unjust to me to have to be in a movie with somebody that was making $22 million and I was supposed to work for a lot less than that. To put it this way, it's better to be number one on the call sheet on a TV show than number seven on a call sheet on a movie. And I also feel like that in today's climate, a lot of the more interesting stuff is being done on TV.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think Deadwood is a lot more interesting than almost every movie being made. I think that The Sopranos has definitely proved that television is better than most movies.
Didn't you almost get the part of Tony Soprano, or at least you were a contender for it?
I was actually sent the script and liked the script very much and committed to doing it. Then the people that we approached, David Chase and I approached to do it as a series, it was a network. I'm not going to get into naming names, but they passed on it. So then it kind of floated around, and I stayed attached to it for a while. And then it went to HBO. But by that time, I had gotten the chance to get View from the Bridge, the Arthur Miller play, up on Broadway, which I've been working on for a while. And so that, together with the fact that over time, David Chase and I think our opinion on how the character, who the character was a little different.
What was your view?
My view was that he was an outsider and that hadn't been involved in the family business and therefore had a slightly more urbane quality to him. So he was more of a fish out of water. And David did not feel that way. David felt that he was, even though he had been out of the family business and had... In the pilot, he'd been out of the family business and come back, and he was seeing a shrink. So I felt that he had, even though he was trying to hide the fact that he was seeing a shrink, he still had a kind of insight that was a little higher than the people around him. And as it turns out, I was wrong, and David Chase was right in his interpretation of who the character should be. Was perfect because James Gandolfini totally embodied that character.
Nevertheless, do you ever watch The Sopranos and think it could have been me?
No, I really don't. I don't envy that, you know. I don't, because I think James Gandolfini is a brilliant actor, and I think that over time he'll turn it into something else. But for a long time, he'll be known as Tony Soprano, and. That's not meant as meant to be detrimental. It's just that he is so incredibly brilliant at that part. So I think that audiences have a hard time associating him with something else, and that's kind of the risk that you take. Whereas the character that I play in Without a Trace is a lot more generic and a lot more less defined.
Yeah, but that's like saying, isn't that like saying, I want to play a character that's more generic and less defined? That's not what you look for in a character.
If you're going to do 7 years on a television series,
yeah,
it's better.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Because at the end of it, you're not locked into, I'll give you a perfect example. If you look at Seinfeld, for example, George Costanza is such an identifiable character that whenever you see Jason Alexander, who's a brilliant actor, do something else, it's hard to get past George Costanza. Whenever you see Michael Richards do something else, it's hard to see past Kramer because they were brilliant. Very defined and brilliant. And therefore, after that portion of your career is over, you then have to reconvince everybody that you're just not that person and there are other things you can do. So therefore, having a character that doesn't have... believe me, I thought it out. it was very carefully thought out, the decision to... take Without a Trace, the reasons to take it, the reasons to play the part the way I play it. It was about longevity after the series is over.
My guest is Anthony LaPaglia. He stars in the new movie Winter Solstice and in the CBS Missing Persons series Without a Trace. He won an Emmy in 2002 for his guest starring role on the series Frasier as Daphne's drunk and obnoxious brother Simon. Here's a scene from an episode in which Simon is staying at Frasier's place and brings a woman with him.
Oh, Frasier, this is Loretta. Loretta, well, you know who you are.
I'm sorry, miss, but we are not entertaining guests this evening. You'll have to leave. Wait, you told me this was your place. You're probably not even the Duke of England.
Oh, yeah? Then why do I talk this way? Well, you're just a big contraceptive, aren't you?
We'll talk more with Anthony LaPaglia after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Anthony LaPaglia, and he stars in the TV series Without a Trace. He's now starring in the new movie Winter Solstice. You grew up in Australia. And
yes, I did, yes.
How old were you when you came to the States?
22.
Okay, I've been listening as you speak for signs of an Australian accent, which I do occasionally hear, but on the whole, you sound pretty American. If I woke you up in the middle of the night and you just started speaking, would you have a more of an Australian accent?
No, this is pretty much my normal accent now. Yeah, after 22 years at first I had to consciously do it just to get work. Because when I first came here 20-something years ago, Australians were not in vogue. They are now. But 20 years ago, if I went into an office to audition for a part and I used my normal accent, I would never get the role. And it took me a few auditions to figure it out. And then I started going in. And basically what would happen is about the time I first got here, Paul Hogan had kind of become a big thing because he had done a tourist ad for Australia. And it was the put another shrimp on the Barbie thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so Americans seemed to be completely enthralled by this commercial. And every time I went in to meet someone and I said I was from Australia, there would be a 20-minute conversation about Paul Hogan and another shrimp on the Barbie and blah, blah, blah. And then I would have to audition. And after every audition, the person would say, I can hear your Australian accent. That's not going to work. And I used to think, oh, that is couldn't possibly be true because I had worked so hard on developing a credible American accent. And I realized that it was the 20-minute conversation about Paul Hogan that was killing me. So
that guy nearly ruined your career. It's not
fair.
Yeah,
he did. He did. And so one day I went into an audition, and the casting director said, where you're from? And I said, Brooklyn. And he went, great, let's read. I read the part, and I got it. And that was it.
So you never went into an audition with an Australian accent again?
Ever.
So how did you work on changing your accent? Like, what did you do?
I was very, I was 22 or 23 years old, and I was very broke, but I managed to get a... You know, New York was fantastic back in the 80s. There was what we used to call sidewalk shopping. And people would just throw stuff out on the sidewalk. And some of it was good. It worked. I got a TV that worked. I got a little couch. I furnished my entire apartment from the sidewalk. And I got a double cassette player that somebody had tossed. And then I got a copy of Dog Day Afternoon. And which was my favorite movie at the time, and I watched it all the time, and then I taped some of it, and so I would tape little fragments of it. And then I would, on the other side, I would play it, and then I would tape myself repeating the sentence on the tape player. And I would do that every day for about an hour. And then I would just go out into the world of New York, and I would just apply my American accent. And within 6 months, I had completely eradicated my Australian accent.
So you modeled your accent on Al Pacino?
I did. It's since kind of developed into its own thing. But in the beginning, it was Al.
Does he know that?
No.
That's really funny.
Although I meet him from time to time. And I just never told him that story.
Well, Anthony LaPaglia, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, it was my pleasure.
Anthony LaPaglia stars in the new movie Winter Solstice. You can also see him in the CBS series Without a Trace. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chilog, Sam Brigger, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording by Ella Fitzgerald. She was born 87 years ago today.
This year's crop of kisses don't seem as sweet to me. This year's crop just misses what kisses used to be. This year's new romance doesn't seem to have a chance, even helped by Mr. Moon above. This year's crop of kisses is not for me, for I'm still wearing last year's love.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
25 years ago, Mirta Ojito was one of the 125,000 Cubans who fled from their country to South Florida in what became known as the Mariel Boatlift. She went on to become a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the New York Times. On the next Fresh Air, we discuss her new memoir about the Cuban exodus. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.